Welcome to another day of Rohatsu Sesshin, our ongoing timeless celebration of Buddha's great awakening. Whatever experiences we may have today and for the rest of our lives, may we be kind and compassionate to them, especially if they're painful and difficult. If we forget what we're doing and are getting lost in confusion, then we can always return to and rely on now. Now is a wondrous refuge. And luckily it is, because we can't escape it. Another way to put it, as an old deadhead that I am, one of the pointing out instructions from the Grateful Dead lyrics in a song that has a lot of filled with koans and unusual pointers, like, in another time's forgotten space, your eyes looked from your mother's face, and so on. But then there's this great line in that song that says, if you get confused, just listen to the music play. And then there's a long instrumental solo with no more words for a while in that song. During this talk today, and during our sitting today, if you get confused, just listen to the music play. Don't have to figure it all out. Because this is celebrating Buddha's awakening, this week we're recounting the story of the Buddha's awakening, the days leading up to it. It's getting closer and closer, of course. And we've reached the point where the Buddha, to be the Bodhisattva, has been trying all these extremely painful ascetic practices of controlling himself, controlling his breath, trying to stop it, trying to stop and control his thoughts, and trying to control his desire by fasting. And he ended up saying, these painful racking feelings for my austerity practice is more painful than any other ascetic has ever experienced, and more painful than anyone ever will. Whatever ascetics experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking, painful practice of austerities, I've not attained any supramundane distinction, any realization that goes beyond the world that I feel like I'm usually trapped in. no distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? The Bodhisattva wonders. Then the sutra goes on. I considered, the Bodhisattva says, I recall that when my father, the Shakyan, was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, secluded from sense pleasures and sense cravings, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, the first meditative absorption, which is accompanied by applied attention and sustained attention to now, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion, seclusion from all the distractions of my usual life. Could this be the path to enlightenment? I remembered this time in my childhood when I naturally, without any meditation instruction, entered into this blissful presence under a cool tree. And I remember that in my non-blissful ascetic practice right now. Could this be the path to enlightenment? Then following on that memory came the realization, this is indeed the path to enlightenment. It's almost like that was like a little mini enlightenment right there. Like it was a revelation, right? It's a change of direction. I have that memory. It's interesting that he didn't remember it until now. Or didn't think that it had anything to do with his path, that childhood experience. Now he thinks, maybe there was something about that. Maybe that was like kind of on the right track. Where did such a memory and a realization come from? We don't know. But there it arose. I thought, he said, why am I afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sense pleasure and unwholesome states? I thought, I'm not afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with the pleasures of the physical senses and unwholesome states. Which is interesting because, you know, as an ascetic, basically, he was quite afraid of pleasure. You know, we're, as ordinary people, we're kind of the opposite, right? We're kind of afraid of pain, right? But he was able to go into the most extreme pain, but what he was really afraid of was happiness, because I think he saw the trap in devotion to pursuing sense pleasures, which he, you know, had tried that path in his youth also. Right? But so kind of like that kind of enjoyable, peaceful, even blissful meditation. Is that okay? He wondered. He thought, actually, I think it's okay. I'm not afraid of it. I considered, it's not easy to attain that happiness with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now at that time, five monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our ascetic Gotama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and porridge, the five monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the ascetic Gotama now lives luxuriously. He's given up his striving and reverted to luxury. just had some like rice, okay? But you know, these guys were like ascetics.
We have that rice porridge on the 8th, the morning of the 8th.
Tasty, huh? And nourishing. So because of that rice porridge, we're not extremely emaciated and weak. And thank you, Tenzo, for continuing to support our comfortable practice. By the way, these five monks, later show up in the sutra that we chant here sometimes. The five monks were glad and they rejoiced at his words. He later met up with them again, right, and taught them the Dharma, and they awakened to the Dharma. But at this time, they're like, forget that guy. He's like reverted to luxury. We'll go fast by ourselves now. Have as much rice as you want, Gotama. We're going back to our fasting. So he let them go. We can imagine, maybe he had some doubt too, they're kind of judging me, am I reverting to luxury? I mean, I've been pretty devoted to this non-luxury for many years now, did he have any doubt? We don't know. It seemed like he had some new confidence that this was the path to eat something. And maybe partly he had the confidence because he tried the other way, like kind of as far as he could go. Now, he says, when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then secluded from sense craving, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, the first meditative absorption, which is accompanied by applied and sustained attention, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. For those who heard the earlier days when he was talking about his austerities, these extremely painful feelings, and he said, but these painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So now he's saying, now these pleasant feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So that's the first meditative absorption called jhana, which is accompanied by, here it says thought and examination, but some debate on its translation issues, and some would say, well, there's in this first jhana, there's definitely no ordinary thinking. So maybe more accurate to say applied attention to the meditation object and sustained attention on the meditation object. One enters the first state of stillness. With the subsiding of applied and sustained attention, I entered and dwelled in the second jhana. So this is, progressive states of meditative absorption. Second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, but is also even without applied and sustained attention. It's like, made this effortful attention on the breath, for example, long enough so that now the mind just stays present without even having to apply it anymore. And this second jhana has rapture and happiness born of concentration also. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. With the fading away as well of rapture, I dwelled equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. I experienced happiness with the body. I entered and dwelled in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, one is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, I entered and dwelled in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So these are these four meditative absorptions that maybe he learned previously, since he learned what was later called the seventh and the eighth jhana, as we heard earlier. But maybe he's discovering this kind of sequence naturally with his nourished, energized body and mind. And, you know, many things could be said about these jhanas. We don't really emphasize these kind of steps and stages in Zen, but you could maybe hear the gist of these was that they start off with more effort, and also they start off with more, like, both mental and physical happiness, and then as they progress, there's less and less effort, and there's less happiness and more equanimity. My understanding is that the deeper meditations, especially kind of bodily bliss, becomes kind of distracting, is how it's taught. It's more wonderful to not be caught in either pain or pleasure, or just be really, really equanimous as it's settled more and more and more deeply. So there'll be one more great episode of the story tomorrow. Stay tuned on this channel. We're also, this session, looking at Dogen Zenji's essay called Daigo, Great Awakening. It seems quite apropos of Rohatsu Sesshin. And, of course, this is based on the Buddha's awakening, but Dogen, of course, centuries later, puts it in a very different way, because this tradition can evolve and metamorphosize, and the expressions are endless, and the skillful means are overflowing, and nothing can stagnate in this realm of great awakening. So it has to be told anew by Dogen and by us today. So, Daigo, Great Satori. And I listened to Okamura Roshi's commentary on this essay, and one of the interesting pieces that might not show up elsewhere that he brought up is there's been a recently discovered copy of this essay by Dogen. I don't know how recent, but I think like in the last decades, and which is just a cool thing about a history, is that things get lost and things get found. So I think there's a few chapters of the Shobo Genzo that are like in Dogen's personal handwriting, but that have been found and archived at Eheiji. But most of them are copied by his disciple Kōun Ejo, and they're always looking for, of course, the earliest copies, because as these were copied from other copies, then mistakes start to get put in there from fast copying and so on. So, and where are these things found? They're found in Zen temples, right, that have storerooms full of old boxes of stuff that nobody's gone through for centuries sometimes, right? And so in the last couple of decades, I think it was probably a Soto Zen temple, or at least that used to have been a Soto Zen temple, and these temples are around for many centuries. Somebody discovered this old handwritten copy of Shobogenzo Daigo, and they think that it was maybe Dogen's draft for this essay, kind of that then he revised and got published later. I don't know if they see Dogen's handwriting, but maybe a copy from a draft of Dogen. These things all start circulating. The old internet before there was internet. And so I think it's cool that they can, who knows what will be found later from Dogen, or they're always, sometimes they find old sutras in weather-protected caves, right? And just as a modern example, here at Warm Jewel Temple, one time I was cleaning up the attic. There's an attic over the deck out here with some old stuff in there, some boxes of stuff, and I found some ancient manuscripts that had not been discovered before. It's true. They were like hand-typed, so there are no digital copies. You could see there was, on a hand typewriter, transcriptions of Kōbun Jinō Roshi's Dharma talks that never been accessed since he gave the talks, and I don't know if the recordings are around, but cool. I thought they were cool. I read them, and I passed them on to the Kōbun archivists, and who were thrilled to find some old texts. So even nowadays, you find 40-year-old treasures instead of 800-year-old treasures. Anyway, in this old copy, there was just a passage that in the draft that didn't make it to the to this published one that we're reading here. And so thank you to Okamura Roshi for mentioning this. And it's not so unfamiliar. It's about dropping off body and mind, which is one of Dogen's favorite sayings. And the passage that it sounds like Dogen put in the original essay and then for some reason he took it out, says, "Dropping off body and mind is body and mind dropped off," which we may hear this kind of thing sometimes in Dogen teachings. It may be related to this essay in the sense that dropping off body and mind sounds like a practice that we do, right? It's like, now let's practice dropping off body and mind. But what is this practice of dropping off body and mind? Is it some new experience or not? So dropping off body and mind, is body and mind dropped off? We might say it like, the practice of dropping off body and mind is the body and mind that have dropped off. I hear this as, and I think Shohaku Okamura also understood this as, it's kind of implying that the practice of dropping off body and mind is just realizing that body and mind have dropped off and have always been dropped off. That's the key thing. Body and mind have always been dropped off. And dropping off body and mind is just according with that reality. That's how we could hear this. Dropping off body and mind is body and mind dropped off. It's nothing in addition to that. It's no new thing in addition to that. Dropping off body and mind is body and mind dropped off. Because dropping off is dropped off, this is called body and mind dropped off. So, I don't know where in that essay that appeared, in that draft, but Dogen likes to bring up this phrase, dropping off body and mind, and it came from his teacher, Tendo Nyojo Daiyosho. And there's conversations in Dogen's journal from China. He records the conversations he had with his teacher about dropping off body and mind. Practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind. And they have some kind of informal conversations, kind of longer conversations about that, which you can read. But Dogen never says anything about, I had this definitive moment of dropping off body and mind, and that was my great enlightenment. Nowhere in any of Dogen's writings does he say that. But a couple generations after Dogen, Keizan Zenji kind of does say that about Dogen. Keizan kind of tells this story. So it could have been an oral transmission that Dogen never wrote down, because it was just maybe, 100 years after Dogen lived. It was recent. Or some modern scholars say that Keizan made up this story, because he had to, because this transmission of light record has to have a Daigo story for every ancestor. And Dogen didn't pull out some particular thing on this particular day, this particular thing happened. So there's some debate in modern Soto Zen of like, was there some special experience for Dogen? If so, why didn't he ever talk about it? Some definitive moment. He talked about his transmission with his teacher, but he didn't talk about some definitive momentary enlightenment experience, like the Buddha's under the Bodhi tree. So we don't know if this was Dogen or if this is Keizan kind of making it up. But in this record of transmitting the light, the Denko Roku, once during late night zazen, Rujing, Tendo Nyojo, told the monks, practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind. We know that Rujing taught that, but we don't know that he taught it on this particular late night zazen period. But he said, practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind. Hearing this, Dogen was suddenly greatly awakened. As it says in the text, Dogen Daigo. Has Daigo in here for in Dogen's story. Dogen experienced great awakening. Was greatly awakened. Realized great Satori. And then he went to the abbot's room and burned incense. And Rujing said, why are you burning incense? And Dogen said, body and mind have dropped off. And Rujing said, body and mind dropping off is the dropped off body and mind. I think it's these same lines from the draft of Daigo. And but now it's being attributed to Rujing. And Dogen said, so Rujing said body and mind dropped off. Dropping off is the dropped off body and mind. And Dogen said, this is just a temporary ability. Don't approve me too easily. And Rujing said, I'm not approving you too easily. And Dogen said, what is it that you're not approving me of too easily? And Rujing said, dropped off body and mind. And Dogen bowed, and Rujing said, the dropping off has dropped off. This is also from that draft of the essay attributed to Dogen, right? Yeah.
Is that phrase that's in that thing, the only place where Dogen says that, or is it somewhere else?
I think that whole thing together, dropping off body and mind, is body and mind dropped off. Because dropping off is dropped off, this is called body and mind dropped off. That maybe, I don't think Dogen says that any other place yet, that whole thing. But it's almost identical to what Kazan says in here, attributed to him, but it's not written anywhere. Yeah, I think interesting, huh? Anyway, it's a dynamic tradition, constantly evolving. And for our purposes, I think that practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind is a wonderful expression, wonderful teaching we can sit with. And also, dropping off body and mind is just, we might say, according with the body and mind that has always been dropped off. Is also a wonderful teaching that's kind of also in accord with this essay. There's so many great Dogen things, right? He says, and he says a lot about Satori, as I mentioned the other day. He talks about Satori exactly 372 times in the Shobogenzo. He's got this essay called Only a Buddha and a Buddha. It's a really good one. But this is a little bit sounding to me like there's some definitive shift. It sounds a little bit more like that than our current essay, Daigo. In this Only a Buddha and a Buddha, Dogen says, when you realize Buddha Dharma, you do not think, this is realization just as I expected. And realization here is Satori. All through this passage, realization is the translation of Satori, so we could say awakening. When you realize Buddha Dharma, you do not think, this is realization just as I expected. Even if you think so, realization invariably differs from your expectation. Realization is not like your conception of it. Accordingly, realization cannot take place as previously conceived. When you realize Buddha Dharma, you do not consider how realization came about. You should reflect on this. What you think one way or another before realization is not a help for realization. Although realization is not like any of the thoughts preceding it, this is not because such thoughts were actually bad and could not be realization. Past thoughts in themselves were already realization. But since you were seeking elsewhere, you thought and said that those thoughts cannot be realization. Nice one. And I just sounded a little bit like a shifting moment, because he says, although realization is not like any of the thoughts preceding it, sounds like a sort of a something that happens in time. Whereas a lot of what he says about it is not happening in time. It's a timeless reality he's talking about. But it's nice. It's a nice teaching, and it's definitely non-duality is the emphasis here, right? That the thoughts we're having, especially the thoughts of like, what's this Satori business all about, and like, I guess it's not for me. And like, why can't I stop thinking and just realize Satori? And or just like, I wish I could just think about Satori a little bit instead of thinking about when Sashin's going to be over. Whatever kind of thoughts there are. None of these thoughts have anything to do with Satori. But interestingly, Dogen says, realization is not like these thoughts. And yet, such thoughts themselves were already Satori. Sounds contradictory. But it doesn't have to be. A hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. It's like, what are these thoughts? And what's wrong with them? He says, such thoughts are bad. And they can't be realization. What is it that each of these thoughts is already realization? It's not so much that the contents of the thoughts is realization, right? But a thought is just a pure expression bubbling up from the depths of Dharmakaya to express itself in this world for the benefit of all beings. Is it lunchtime yet? Ah, what a like beautiful gift to the world, that thought. Yes.
So I hear you going back to your first reading of the Book of Serenity. All thoughts, structures, instructions that we're doing about Satori. And here's this episode of shining in consciousness that you just go, oh, what? Who was he? Does it matter? And there it is. There's the opening. Which, you know, has surfaced again for the Buddha. And there's all this other Buddha study practices. Not that we do those, but we do a lot of Fananda, you know, with all that stuff. And then hearing that beautiful event where we did drop away and which is so delicious. And so peaceful and whole.
And available every moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that can't be it. That's not the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then so many Zen teachings about how shouldn't it be more dramatic?
Yeah, right. I was just thinking subtle. Yeah, so subtle. And
yeah, like, shouldn't it be flashier? Shouldn't it be more blissful? We hear, I think it's kind of a dangerous word, bliss, because we think, I should just feel ecstatic. But maybe it could just be like, you know, I'm just sitting here and like, on the sixth day of Sashin and, you know, it's okay. It's okay. I don't mind. I don't mind sitting here another period or another. In fact, I'm not even keeping track anymore. I'm just like sitting here on a sore butt. Is it okay that my butt's sore? Well, why wouldn't it be? I mean, it's okay. But what about our time is limited in realizing great Satori? Come on, shape up, Kokyo. Get it together. Come on. Is that okay to be that way? Is anyone saying it's not okay? Yes, Gonkyo, it's not okay. Who said that? Or is it? Oh, you're me who said that. Are you allowed to say? You can even say that. You're allowed to say, it's not okay. Is it okay to say it's not okay? Wow. Maybe it's okay to say it's not okay. Maybe it's even okay to talk like this. Dogen says, therefore, when you grope around for the one who returns to delusion and got him firmly in your clutches, you will encounter the person of great awakening. When you grope around for the one who returns to delusion and have got him firmly in your clutches, you will encounter the person of great awakening. I finally got this returning to delusion person. And what is it? Actually, it's great awakening. Maybe I should tell the story for Pablo hasn't heard the original story that Dogen's commenting on here in this great Satori essay. A monk comes to a teacher and says, how is it when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? And the teacher says, a broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen flowers cannot climb back up on the tree. And we're interpreting that as the mirror in which, like, I'm looking at a reflection separate from me, a kind of dualistic mirror. A mirror of dualistic perception is broken and will never shine again. And the flowers of all our, like, habit patterns of grasping and believing that it's really not okay have all dropped off, and they never can climb back on the tree. It's kind of this sort of emphasizing, it sounds like to me, this kind of irreversibility of great Satori in the original story. So a broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen flowers can't climb back onto the tree. That's the story that Dogen's now talking about. That's why he can say, when you grope around for one who returns to delusion and have got him firmly in your clutches, you will encounter the person of great awakening. It's referring to these two parts of the story. We're exploring the relationship in the story between great awakening and returning to delusion. This is well worth exploring, this relationship. Is the self right now, and I would understand this jiko self to be, I would say, the true self. We've been talking about self a lot this fall. I think this is the big self, the all-inclusive self. Is this self right now, or we could even say the self of right now, the self we call now, that self, the now that includes all past and future experiences, the eternal now, the eternal self, is the self of right now returning to delusion? Is it returning to non-delusion? You should examine this and bring it here. This is to meet with the Buddhas and ancestors. The teacher in the story said, a broken mirror doesn't reflect again. The fallen flowers can't climb back on the tree. This instruction to the assembly speaks of precisely the moment of the broken mirror. We might say precisely the time of the broken mirror, which must be right now. this statement, a broken mirror doesn't shine again, doesn't reflect again, fallen flowers can't go back on the tree. This saying speaks of precisely the time of the broken mirror. So let's relate to the story at the time when reified dualistic perception is broken. Let's just suspend our view that the duality of me and you is real. And might still appear like we're separate, but could this mirror actually be broken? Already broken, inherently broken. Like the way it actually is. Thus, to study the words, broken mirror, while having in mind the time when the mirror was not yet broken, is not right. Okay. Let's study the words, broken mirror, not referring to the time before the mirror was broken. The meaning of this saying by this teacher, Hua Yan, broken mirror doesn't reflect again and fallen flowers can't climb up the tree, has likely been understood as saying the person of great awakening doesn't reflect again and the person of great awakening can't climb back up the tree again, saying that the person of great awakening does not again return to delusion. That's, I think he's talking about, this is how we would ordinarily, most people would understand the story. How, in other words, they never will return to delusion. Right? However, Dogen says it's not such a study. If it were as most people have thought, this teacher would be asking something like, or the monks who's asking the question would be asking something like, how about the everyday life of a person of great awakening? What's it like when they're kind of like interacting in the messy world, separate from their great awakening? And in answering, it would be like the teacher saying, well, there are some times when a person returns to delusion. Sometimes they just get caught up in stuff and, things trigger them and they get caught by some old delusion. That's how people, I think, maybe are relating to this story, right? There are some times when an awakened person really gets caught up in stuff, and that's called returning to delusion. The saying, the present case is not like this, though. It's not like that kind of a thing. Just temporarily getting caught by stuff. We could explore that too, but that's a kind of a dualistic separation between great awakening and returning to delusion. Since this monk asks, what about when the person of great awakening returns to delusion? He's asking at precisely the moment of returning to delusion, which we could hear as, once you start asking questions and get into these like dialogues and things like that, this would be one way of understanding returning to delusion. We're just sitting here, you and I, until only you remain. There's no self-consciousness needs to be going on here. But then we have a question. Well, how is it like when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? This question is precisely the moment we call returning to delusion. It's like we're willing to do that, to ask a question. We're willing to return to delusion, so we can ask a question about returning to delusion. We're willing to engage in this world of self and other, where I ask you a question, and could say, it's kind of returning to delusion to get involved in discussions at all. I mean, this Dharma talk is just a heap of returning to delusion. Right? Oh, it's okay. Is it okay? Okay. So asking this is asking it at precisely the moment of returning to delusion. The saying that appears or manifests at such a time, the saying that genjos, the saying, where does the saying come from? It manifests in this world. It's actualized at such a time. Genjo, emo, kind of saying. Broken mirror doesn't reflect again. The falling flower can't climb back out on the tree. That saying that manifests at such a time. That saying is what manifests at such a time. This is going to be a good one. Oh, man.
We'll sit another 7 days.
Okay, because this one, like, you know, there's another story that has to be brought up to understand this sentence. Dogen says, when the fallen flower is truly a fallen flower, even if it climbs back up and beyond 100-foot pole, it is still a fallen flower. Maybe some of you know the Zen story about the 100-foot pole. Dogen's always pulling in pieces of other stories. It's case 79 in the Book of Serenity, where Changsha, an ancestor I'm very fond of, says the person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though she's gained entry, this is not yet the real, or it's not yet complete. And I think one way to understand this is like the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, all these feet of the pole, like it's a kind of gradual climbing. Sesshin day one, sesshin day two, sesshin day three, like gradually and effortfully climbing up the pole to great enlightenment, I think is the metaphor of this 100-foot pole. So the teacher says the person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, they made it. They climbed up gradually through great effort to the top of this pole. The person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, she's gained entry, but it's not yet completely the reality. Atop the 100-foot pole, she should step forward, and the whole universe in 10 directions will be the entire body. It's a great story, I think, right? We refine our practice with great effort. Yes, I finally made it at the top, but this teacher's saying, now we have to step forward off the top of the pole. Kind of scary. We don't know what might happen. But that's when the whole universe is the true body. Instead of just like, don't shake that pole down below there. Like, I'm kind of like perched in a kind of precarious balance up here. Really still, nobody sneeze. This is like, no, you got to get over that. Like, not only can someone sneeze, but you're going to, like, step off the top of the pole. So how interesting that Dogen's bringing this up here. And, of course, it's related because the original saying here is, the fallen flowers cannot climb back up the tree, is the saying. How is it when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? The fallen flowers cannot climb back up on the tree. So this issue of climbing up something, Dogen says here, when the fallen flower is truly a fallen flower, even if it climbs back up and beyond the 100-foot pole, it's still a fallen flower. So you could say, the fallen flowers of all that stuff we're holding on to is fallen, and it can't climb back up on the tree. In the original story, right? Dogen says, even if it does climb up this 100-foot pole and beyond the 100-foot pole and falls down again off the 100-foot pole and then climbs up the 100-foot pole again and falls down and, like, climbs up and falls down over and over, that's still just a fallen flower. So you could say, even after the fallen flower where that can't kind of revert to delusion, you can still sit sesshin and, like, make a great effort and day after day and pretending that we're maybe even going somewhere. We're allowed, a fallen flower is allowed to make great effort and study the gradual path, practice the jhanas if we want to, and the stages of awakening, and then realize that, like, we're kind of like stuck in a model of stages, and leap off that and fall again, joyfully fall, and then see another pole, like, well, let's try to climb that one too. We're allowed to. Is that okay? Really? Okay. If we want to, we don't have to do anything ever that we don't want to. And in fact, I would even propose, we can't do anything we don't want to. Or another way to say it is, we are always doing what we want to. We can't avoid it. Did the Buddha want to, like, almost kill himself through austerities? Looks like it, because that's what happened, right? Did the Buddha want to give that up and try another way? Looks like it. So I think it's nice to remember that if we ever feel like, I really don't want to be doing this right now, we can say to ourselves, but actually, I do, because here I am. And we're completely free to climb up poles and leap off them. There will be consequences to every single thing that we do, right? But do we want to receive the consequences? The more we see that there are consequences to everything we do, then maybe what we want to do starts getting more and more refined as we see that, like, yes, I do want to do this, and I see the consequences, and actually I don't really want to do it anymore. So, but we still are always doing what we want to. Since a broken mirror is precisely a broken mirror, however many activities of life it expresses or manifests, Genjo, they will all be reflections that don't reflect again. since a broken mirror is precisely and definitively a broken mirror, however many activities that this broken mirror expresses, they will all be reflections that don't reflect again. This integration of the two truths. The mirror never reflects again is like the ultimate truth. And the myriad manifestations of all these activities of life will all be reflections that don't reflect again. They seem to be appearing, but they're not really the reflections that don't reflect again. Can you follow? Not reflect again in this story, right, is like no more dualistic perception, right? And so all these activities, since the mirror is completely broken, there is no more dualistic perception. There never really was any dualistic perception. Therefore, since a broken mirror is precisely a broken mirror, since non-duality is precisely non-duality, however many dualistic activities and appearances of daily life this non-duality expresses or manifests, they will all be reflections or appearances that don't really reflect again. So, Dogen's so poetic. He could just say it like that, right? But he makes his work for it. Taking up the meaning of the saying broken mirror and saying fallen flower, we should inquire into the time when the person of great awakening returns to delusion. It's not that we should study this as if great awakening were like becoming a Buddha and returning to delusion were like a sentient being. It's not like that. It's not saying, as it's sometimes put, again to become a living being, or saying something like, quote, leaving traces in the phenomenal world from the original ground, unquote. And according to Okamura Roshi, this is a saying that's used in Japan to integrate Buddhism and Shintoism. So it's maybe like a Shinto phrase that gets used in Buddhism, and the idea of trying to integrate these two religions, probably a long time ago, is that is this understanding that Buddha, like the Dharmakaya Buddha, can manifest anything to benefit beings. So the Buddha manifests as these kami, which are the Shinto spirits, like nature spirits. The trees have a tree kami, and the rocks have a rock kami, right? In Shintoism, it's like everything has its own spirit. So this way of integrating, apparently it was like, well, these are just one thing. It's like Dharmakaya Buddha is coming into like rocks and trees as these rocks and tree spirits. These are the Shinto kami spirits are really just manifestations of the Buddha. Sounds like a nice integration, right? And I think so. But he's saying that kind of understanding is not quite what we're talking about here. It's not that something really big and vast then becomes manifest as something small. Like two different realities. He's saying, if we see that in some sort of dualistic way, that's not quite right. This is why Dogen says, that talks as if one destroys great awakening to become a living being or to become some sort of spirit. It destroys the totality to become this individual. if we see it that way, that would be the problem. This is not saying that one destroys great awakening. It's not saying that one loses great awakening. It's not saying that delusion has come. We should not identify it with those views. Sentient beings and Buddhas are not two. Truly great awakening is without boundary, and returning to delusion is without boundary. There's no delusion that obstructs great awakening. Taking up three pieces of great awakening, we make half a piece of slight delusion. Okamura Roshi brought up the image of just like, I think it's a nice one to think about now. Great awakening and returning to delusion are like these optical illusions where you have like a vase. Everybody's probably seen that illusion, right? There's a picture of a vase and it's two faces on the side, right? Like a black and white image. You have like a white vase, decorative vase, and two black faces, and the shapes of their profiles make the shape of the vase, right? And so great awakening and returning to delusion are like this. You can see it as a vase, and at that time you don't really see the two faces, and you can see it as the two faces, but you don't see the vase. And yet, it's one picture, completely one picture, right? It's not two different things. But we could say it's two perspectives. We see one or the other. At the time of great awakening, we don't see it as returning to the illusion. At the time of returning to delusion, we don't see it as great awakening. At the time of Buddha, we don't see it as sentient being. At the time of sentient being, we don't see it as Buddha. But it's one reality. The two faces don't obstruct the vase. I think that's it. Particularly relevant to this obstruction. That makes sense, right? That the two faces in this optical illusion don't obstruct the vase, and the vase doesn't obstruct the two faces. So there's no delusion, Dogen says, that obstructs great awakening. With this, there are snowy mountains, or Himalayas, having great awakening for the sake of snowy mountains. Maybe referring to, in Zen they sometimes say Buddha practiced in the snowy mountains. So the trees and rocks have great awakening in the form of trees and rocks. So interestingly, in Dogen's essay called Arousing Bodhicitta, the Unsurpassed Mind, he quotes Baijiang as saying, snow mountains are like great nirvana. And Bodhidharma says, the mind in each moment is like trees and rocks. So maybe comparing big mountains and little trees, but to these two different Zen sayings, and then he's bringing them up side by side again in this essay. When he says, there are snow mountains having the great awakening for the sake of snow mountains. Trees and rocks have great awakening in the form of trees and rocks. The great awakening of the Buddhas has the great awakening for living beings. Great awakening of living beings has great awakening to the great awakening of Buddhas. This has nothing to do with before or after. The present great awakening is not self and not other. It has not come yet. It fills the ditches and clogs the gullies. Great awakening has not come, and yet it fills the ditches and clogs the gullies. Some Zen phrase for like filling everywhere. It has not gone. So great awakening has not come, and it's not gone. Yet, seeking, going along with the other is prohibited. Why is this so? As it said, it goes along with the other. I'll just finish because I think it's a great way that he refers to these two wonderful Zen stories of Dongshan's awakening verse, when he crossed the stream and saw his reflection in the stream and woke up to non-duality. Dongshan said, "Never seek it going along, following others." Sometimes we translate, "Never seek from another, lest it recede far from yourself." You know, I now go on alone, yet everywhere I meet it. It now in truth is me, I now am not it. It must be understood like this to accord with suchness. It's a classic verse of Dongshan. But the first line is, never seek it following another. Don't try to seek it from another. But literally it's following other. Don't seek it following other. So that's Dongshan's saying. And then we have this other saying, when the fire at the end of the eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? And the teacher Das Wei says, it's destroyed. And the monk says, then it goes along with that other? Literally, says, and Das Wei says, it goes along with the other. In other words, the whole universe goes along with it, but in Chinese it's go along with other. And it's the same three characters as Dongshan's verse. Don't go along with the other. So Dogen did this kind of stuff, right? He pulled out these two stories. So here, back to Dogen's thing. Great awakening has not gone anywhere. Yet, as Dongshan says, seeking it going along with another should not be done. Don't seek it going along from another. I think it's because we're talking about gone, right? Great awakening has not gone anywhere. So don't seek it going along with the other. Why is this so? As it said by Dasui, it goes along with the other when the universe is destroyed. So, it's kind of complex here, right? But, this is the kind of thing that Dogen does. You could spend like hours just looking at these few sentences and seeing how he packs in three different complex Zen stories into like one sentence, really. But the gist is that we're just not falling into any side of, it's not that, that it's a matter of like following others, that a great awakening is gotten from going along with others or getting it from another. And yet great awakening does go along with the other, always goes along with the other. There's no separation. So it's just to keep us flexible. But he's, you know, it's hard to be so flexible when he talks so much. But that's what he's, maybe he's testing us, right? At the beginning of the page, he's like, we should work at this a bit. So we're giving it a try. It's like climbing up a 100-foot pole to read Dogen, I think. And but we don't mind, as a fallen flower, we don't mind climbing up this nitpicky, like convoluted, weirdo Zen talk.
The pole is greased.
The pole is totally greased. So we can see the top and we like to get there, even though now we're even hearing like you shouldn't really hang out up there either, but we're still trying to climb up the greased pole. So as a fallen flower. If you get confused, just listen to the music play. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.